This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, here we are. Skyrocketing rents, neighborhoods undergoing massive transformation, a little-known ripple effect in the massive changes in Boston's housing market. It is the final day of our special series, Evictions in East Boston, the push for a just cause eviction ordinance. On Monday, we heard from housing advocates and tenants who believe East Boston is the epicenter of an eviction crisis.
Y eso es injusto. That's
unjust. They put us in this situation. We didn't ask to leave our homes, especially in the way they threw us out.
This is a citywide crisis, but this is the heart of the crisis.
It's displacement on a massive scale because rents are rising so rapidly that no mortals can pay them.
Están desalojando mucha gente.
Because they're dislocating a lot of people, because they've realized, how do I put this? It's a gold mine.
On Tuesday, landlords and developers weighed in, saying changing any eviction laws could undermine Boston's economic growth.
It is going to be an absolute nightmare, and it will chill the market in Boston and send us back to the dark ages of rent control.
If you freeze the neighborhoods as they are, not put money into them, leave the rents where they are, not allow capital improvements, this is just going downward.
Gentrification is a sign of economic strength. It's a good thing.
And yesterday, we looked to San Francisco to learn what happens when even stronger eviction laws are in effect. Longtime Bay Area residents and city officials told us they're at risk of losing the San Francisco they love without immediate action on deeper, lasting solutions.
Getting more housing permits issued both in San Francisco and the surrounding communities and dealing with the regulatory roadblocks, I would say, is number one.
We do need to build, but it needs to be deeply affordable housing if we're actually going to address the needs that actually exist in the city.
Until we deal with that structural issue that we don't have enough housing, this will continue to be an explosive situation.
We're going to keep coming back and disrupting their lives because their policies and their lack of policies are disrupting us so much that we can't even stay in the city anymore.
Well, today, we want to turn the conversation to you. You have been emailing and tweeting us and calling us all week about this. Today, you can call and get on the air. Tenants, landlords, students, everyone, are we in the midst of an eviction crisis? What do you think of a just cause eviction proposal? And more importantly, what is the role of government here? As the region undergoes rapid transformation, how do we promote growth and prevent displacement simultaneously? Those are the big questions we want to tackle today, and we want to hear from you. So call us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Well, in just a minute, we're going to be joined by a city official who has a lot to say about this. But first, let me introduce our two guests who are in the studio today. Chris Herbert, he's the managing director at the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard University. He's one of our guests, and welcome to Radio Boston.
Great to be here.
Thanks. It's great to have you as well. Also with us is Justin Steele, an assistant professor of law and urban planning at MIT. Justin Steele, welcome to you.
Thank you for having us.
Okay. Well, first of all, let me just reiterate kind of what we know about the just cause eviction ordinance that was proposed. It did not make it in front of the city council this week, their last meeting of the year. However, activists are quite optimistic that it may make it in front of the city council at the beginning or near the beginning of next year. And the ordinance would call for any evictions that for month-to-month tenants that were due to rent increases, that they would be asked to go into non-binding mediation if the rent increase was more than 5%. Of course, there would be exceptions for landlords who own fewer than 4 units, and if the landlord wanted to use the units for families. So there are some exceptions here, but essentially those are the broad outlines of what the just cause eviction ordinance proposal is. So with that in mind, Chris and Justin, let me just first start with you and ask you, what do you make of the fact that there are people who are saying that there's an eviction crisis in Boston and that they believe we need some kind of new law to help soften the crisis? And Chris, let me start with you.
Well, there's no question that we're at a crisis of rental affordability. You know, we're seeing it not just in Boston, but across the country. And there's a lot of focus on what's happening with rents. That's certainly the case here in Boston. But it's also important to remember that it's partly an income story as well. And so we're pinning a lot of this on the real estate market. I think it is as much a fact that real rents have been rising as the fact that real renter incomes have been falling. So I think that we have to remember that's part of the story as well. And I think that it is goes back to the question of basic supply and demand and that the fact that we haven't been building enough housing. So I think when we think about the landlord's role in this, and certainly there's reasons to be concerned about whether or not people are getting fair returns, particularly at times when we're seeing market rents increase so rapidly. I think there's we have to look at both what's happening on the supply side and the demand side.
So we'll talk about the supply side a little bit more in a minute. But can you just, Justin, weigh in here? What's your initial thought?
I would reiterate everything that Chris said. I think there is a crisis in Boston and across the country in terms of housing costs, especially rental housing costs, and that is both an issue of housing supply and production and also of incomes. And I would just add and emphasize that I think people are right to be concerned about eviction because the increased residential mobility that happens as renters are forced out of their apartments is associated with a lot of negative outcomes, including poor school performance, health risks, psychological costs, and a loss of neighborhood ties that we value.
Mm. Well, so let me ask you both, like more directly, there isn't just one solution here to the housing and rental crisis. That is one of the reasons why we wanted to talk about the crisis through the lens of these evictions. Do you think a just cause eviction ordinance is a part, is it a good part of a solution? I mean, lots of people do not at all, but do you see it as part of a suite of solutions?
You know, so I'm not a lawyer. Don't play one on TV. And I haven't studied up the specifics of this ordinance. So that said, I mean, I do think there's reasons to be concerned when you have rents rising as rapidly as are now about what impact that does have on a community. So I think if there are ways in which we can slow that process or control that process in a way that doesn't result in such turmoil for individuals and for communities, they're worth considering.
I think that the just cause eviction ordinance does seem to be an important part of addressing this. I think that creating an opportunity for tenants to have someone represent them in mediation, as the ordinance proposes, could go a long way to bringing to slowing down the process of evictions and making sure that people aren't kicked out of their homes unnecessarily.
Okay, so with that in mind, let me play a piece of tape that listeners heard earlier this week. This is, again, from San Francisco, because we felt like we had a lot to learn from San Francisco. Their housing market is just like ours, writ larger, the problems. But they've also been quite aggressive on the eviction front legally. I mean, they just a couple months ago passed another Eviction Protection Act, which is even stronger than the one that's being proposed here in Boston. And with that in mind, we spoke to Carol Galante, who's a professor of affordable housing at UC Berkeley, and she said that despite rent control, which is in effect in San Francisco, and other tenant protections, she says, really, the problem in San Francisco continues to be something bigger, and that these other measures may simply just be Band-Aids, and here she is.
I mean, I understand why communities, you know, have rent control and why it's an important protection at one level, but the problem is it's almost like, you know, morphine, where it's masking the pain for a terminal patient. It's not curing the disease, which is, you know, broad affordability for a community.
So, Justin Steele, let me turn back to you on that. I mean, I heard you say that just cause eviction might be part of the picture here, but as Carol Galante says, she calls it more like morphine to dull the pain.
I wouldn't describe it as morphine. I would tend to agree that it's only one small piece of a solution and that the larger issues are both stagnant or declining real wages for the majority of Americans and increasing rents because of a lack of supply. But I think that a just cause eviction policy could be an important part of trying to reduce the pain of the problem we're facing.
Chris Herbert, do you see any unintended consequences of further tenant protections? Because that's something that came up a lot in our discussions over the course of this week.
Well, depending upon how it's structured, there certainly can be. You know, I think that once you set in place rent control, for example, this isn't, I guess what Just Cause is not rent control, so make that clear. But if you have rent control, then you are talking about whole systems that have to be in place about who determines the rent, how much it changes, well, how do you treat investments, how do you treat turnover to owner-occupied units and the like. But I'd like to go back to your quote from Carol for a second. I do think it's important when she says it's you know, you're not dealing with a larger issue here. And I think it is important if we kind of separate it out into different groups of people, right? And there's some people who have, you know, they may not be the wealthiest people but have means to pay rent. But when rent is going up 10%, 15% a year, then that's a shock that they can't manage. But there's maybe a way in which controlling those increases would make it something that more palatable or more possible. But I think when we're talking about people at the lowest end of the income spectrum, that you really don't get enough from what they can afford to maintain the housing. And I thought the piece about East Boston where the back of the house fell off mm-hmm. is an indication when you're only getting $800 a month, that may not be enough to maintain that property in a condition that's safe and sanitary. So that means that even keeping rents down, there's operating costs, there's property taxes. You have to make sure you're getting enough to maintain the building.
Okay, so you mentioned East Boston because obviously that's the epicenter of our focus. That's where we're taking a close look at. And here's one thing which I don't think maybe we emphasized enough, something that the tenant advocates kept telling us, because everyone acknowledges that gentrification happens. I mean, neighborhoods rise and fall over time. It's part of the long-term cycles of cities and neighborhoods. But not one single advocate used the term gentrification with us. They all persistently said displacement, displacement, mm-hmm. displacement, because of the speed at which this is happening. And what they were saying in East Boston is that that they're not just seeing, you know, people not being able to pay because their rent has gone up 10 or 20 or 30% over several years, but it's happening almost instantaneously. So here's a little bit of tape from Lisa Owens Pinto. She's the executive director of City Life Vita Urbana.
At City Life alone, we've seen a dramatic increase in the number of tenants who are coming complaining about these massive displacements. So it's not just one tenant who receives these notices to quit, it's the entire building.
And what they claim is that there are developers who have a vision for East Boston. And that vision is not necessarily what is there now. They want to sell a new neighborhood, but that neighborhood currently doesn't exist. In order to create it, in order to develop it, they need to get the current tenants out. So it's the speed and intensity issue. And there's no way, I mean, what I'm wondering is, people can contest whether or not that's true, but there's no way that incomes can keep up with that when that's the force behind the change, or one of the forces, Justin Style.
Yes, you know, there's... There was an influential study in 2004, 2005 by Lance Freeman and Frank Bocconi in New York that suggested that actually lower income households often seem to move out of gentrifying neighborhoods slightly less often than other low income households in the city. And I've been doing some research trying to update that for the 2000s. They were looking at the 1990s. And I think we're seeing a very different situation in the past decade, where the preliminary results that we have so far suggest that households are much more likely to move out of gentrifying neighborhoods, presumably because of the increase in housing costs. And one of the things that enables people to stay is being in rent-regulated housing in New York, which has a provision that's stronger than the Just Cause eviction provision, but along the same lines that you have an automatic lease renewal if you're in a rent-regulated unit. So I think that suggests that there are some policies that can mitigate some of the gentrification pressures. Mm.
Well, we are talking about evictions in East Boston and the push for a Just Cause eviction ordinance that could make it harder to evict month-to-month tenants simply for major rent increases alone, and what that means for regarding the picture of Boston's overall housing market. I'm joined by Chris Herbert. He's Managing Director at Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies, and Justin Steele, Assistant Professor of Law and Urban Planning at MIT. And I can see the calls are coming in. We will get to you callers in just a second, but I do want to introduce the voice of the city here, Sheila Dillon. She is the Chief of Housing and Director of the Department of Neighborhood Development for the City of Boston. Sheila Dillon, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So first of all, a little earlier this week, your boss, Mayor Walsh, was actually asked if he would support a just cause eviction ordinance. And he said that you've had some conversations about this at City Hall. And if things worked out, that we, quote, we could do something. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. I mean, the mayor was talking earlier, as he's talking a lot about displacement these days, and very, very concerned about it. We are taking a look at it here in the city as one tool, and one small tool, but we haven't come to any, you know, decisions yet. We've been very, very focused, as you know, on increasing the supply of housing for all income levels, given our population growth.
Right.
But we are looking at that and other things as well.
Right. And in fact, the Boston 2030 plan calls for more than, 53,000 new units.
That's right. And, you know, to date, we've permitted 16,000, not just market rate units, but, you know, we've really worked very, very hard at creating a lot of new affordable and middle-income housing as well, because as people keep coming, it's putting more and more pressure on our housing stock.
Yeah, so Sheila, let me ask you, though, because here's the question that kept coming in my head over and over and over again, and I might be at risk of asking it about 10 times today, and that is, the Boston 2030 plan is very ambitious, 53,000 units, 20%. Increase in the city's overall housing stock. But 2030 is also 15 years from now.
That's right.
There are many people that we spoke to walking the streets of East Boston who say, I'm getting kicked out today or next month, that the problem is so acute right now. I mean, what is the role? Is there a role for government in sort of softening that the acute nature of the problem now as the new housing stock comes online?
Absolutely. I think that's a very, very fair question. I got to say that even though the plan goes out to 2030, many, many departments here at the city are working, you know, around the clock to build housing, because that is the permanent solution here. We're going to have our best year ever with a number of affordable housing starts. But still, people are getting rent increases, and we have to, you know, work with them very, very closely to make sure that they've got the right legal representation. And they are, I think it went, you had mentioned, or someone mentioned earlier, sometimes their incomes are so low that they have to get into an affordable rent-regulated unit. And so we're working with many families and individuals right now trying to get them those units. Boston's got about 50,000 affordable housing units in the city of Boston, and sometimes people that are working two and three jobs need a lot of help to find the right unit that's good for their family.
Yeah. Well, Sheila Dillon, Justin Steele, and Chris Herbert, I'll stand by for just a minute because I have promised our callers that we'll let them in. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-8255. Talk. We're talking about evictions in East Boston. You guys have been reaching out to us all week, so let's put you on the air. Maria is calling from Eggleston Square. You're on the air, Maria. Maria, are you there?
Yes.
Hi.
My name is Maria, and I'm a tenant organizer. I live in the Eggleston Square area, and I'm sitting in the kitchen of a tenant household that I'm working with, where they are going through a no-fault eviction after an investor purchased their house. And I'm seeing splashed all over the headlines today, Martin Shkreli, the touring pharmaceuticals, with a 5,000% increase for a vital medication. And, you know, he's been vilified. I guess he's going to look at jail time for securities fraud now. Mm-hmm. But what I want to see is, where are these unregulated Wild West, speculators going to be held accountable for what they're doing to families in our neighborhood? Because East Boston is just one example of many neighborhoods. I'm here with a youth leader, Marvin Mendoza, who is 17 years old. He's in high school. He's just turned 18, and he is trying to focus on his future, and yet he's been told every week, we have to move this week, we have to move this week. And the purchaser of his house made a 1,400% profit in the sale.
And Maria, let me just jump in here because let me just jump in here, Maria, for a second, because I appreciate your passion and I can hear it. But you talked about holding developers and speculators to account, but there is nothing to hold them to account for. What they are doing is legal. This is just an outcome of the very intense housing market that we're in. So what kind of accountability would you seek? Maria?
We support passing a just cause eviction law so that when a developer is purchasing a house like this, where I'm sitting in right now, that they are going to have to negotiate responsibly with the tenants, they're going to have to mediate over rents, and they're not going to be able to purchase with a business plan of displacement, purchase for 15 times more than what the previous owner bought it for, knowing that the tenants in there are hardworking people, doubled up families, families that are working many jobs and that are trying to make ends meet and that can only pay a certain rent. What
yeah.
the building has been producing in terms of rental income is what they should base their offer on.
Maria, I'm going to jump in here, and forgive me for cutting you off because I don't want you to think that I don't want to hear the rest of your story, but we have so many other people who want to join us. Thank you so much for your call. Chris, Justin, and Sheila, you heard just their one housing organizer who believes that the policies should be even more aggressive, even more in-depth. I mean, Chris, what's your reaction to that?
Well, you know, it's a heartbreaking story when you're talking about that level of increase, someone who's lived in the community for a long time. I mean, I think it goes back to the story we've been talking about all through here, is how do you put some controls on that so it isn't so abrupt. I mean, we do have to deal with the fact that market forces are raising prices, that ultimately you can't push that C back. And so we're making landlords pay for what might be more of a public sector cost as well.
Hold that thought. I want to come back to that in a second. But let's go to Amy, who's calling from Andover. You're on the air, Amy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. We just found out last week that our country is no longer a middle-class majority. And so I definitely think that the professor's point about income is well taken, that we're looking at decreased incomes in terms of now as we see with inflation growth. And so to Sheila's point about the 53,000 units for 2030 and 16,000 permits, I think we need to continue to incentivize for developers to build affordable. We do a lot of low-income starts, but I appreciated hearing that Sheila was saying we need to do more housing for middle income. And I believe Harvard and the hospital areas are looking at that as we see some of the, you know, senior residents not being able to afford housing. You know, a doctor can't get a place in Boston kind of thing. And
right. So, well, Amy, let me just jump in here because I want to turn your point back to Sheila Dillon. Thank you so much for your call, Amy. I mean, Sheila, in the mayor's 2030 housing plan, there's quite a sizable section on the fact that middle-class housing is squeezed from both ends, and you have some very specific goals there. Let me just ask you, on one of them, for example, working with the building trades to reduce the construction costs of middle-class housing, which is one of the things that maybe developers cite as preventing them from making more middle-class housing as opposed to luxury housing. How far along is the city on that?
Well, we're having, you know, great conversations, and the unions are working on some developments right now. Our numbers for middle-class production or housing that's affordable to the middle class, they're very, very solid. We're putting out land. We are working with the trades. We have filed at the state tax relief for developers that are developing middle-income housing. So we're making a lot of progress. One thing I did want to mention, too, though, which I think is a very important component of this, is that we need to, as speculators are going into markets and they're acquiring properties, we have to help the nonprofits and the more benevolent for-profits acquire those properties as well. And they're hard to manage, they're hard to buy because they're small. They're 3, they're 6, they're 8 units. But we have started having conversations with nonprofits. We've also got to have nonprofits go and buy and stabilize those rents. Because those are the units that we're seeing a lot of pain.
Right. Well, Justin and Chris, do you have a thought on that? I'm seeing you shake your heads.
I was just wanted to add to the conversation, too, this issue about home ownership. And so when we're talking about displacement, we're talking a lot about renters is because renters don't have a stake in the property in those communities. And so, in particular, when you're talking about middle-income households, I think part of the conversation would be how do we create more homeownership opportunities so that when an area does gentrify, that the benefits of that are actually, you know, captured by the people who live there. And so if these people own these properties, then they're not being displaced. They're actually getting the benefit and stay in that community. And so it needs to be part of the conversation as well.
Justin Style?
One thing I wanted to raise is that Maria raised the issue of the extreme levels of speculation and tremendous profits that are being made by some property purchasers and real estate developers. And I think this is not a silver bullet. It's only a small piece of the solution. But I think Boston is at the forefront of movements around land trusts, community land trusts, housing land trusts. And I think that's an interesting model to try and take some of these properties and some of the land value out of the speculative market.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, speaking of that, on the story that we reported on Monday with Olga Pasco, who's the tenant who was evicted or in the process of getting evicted from her building on Maverick Street, as we reported, the investment group that had purchased that and several other buildings, the total purchase price was roughly $5 million, but the amount of financing attached to it was $18 million for all these properties. So clearly there's a vision there that those properties will eventually produce $18 million of value. I mean, that's a threefold increase that speculators, developers, whatever you want to call them, see the potential in those buildings in East Boston. And that just seems typical of what we're seeing now. I mean, Sheila Dillon, do you have a thought on that?
Well, there is a lot of capital, low-interest capital right now, and investors are accessing that. And as interest rates remain very, very low in banks, people are looking to place their money and invest. I think what's going to be really important in these neighborhoods, as you know, and the BRA is looking at this as well, is that when we develop these neighborhoods, that they don't just become one income, that we do see some market rate development, we see new development, but we're very, very intentional about building and preserving the affordable housing that's there as well. Mm. I mean, we're seeing this, you know, it is East Boston, it's Chinatown, it is Eggleston Square, where Maria was calling from, but we have to be very intentional on what we're allowing to be built. We, you know, the mayor's been very clear. He wants to see every neighborhood diverse. He wants to see incomes of, you know, people of all incomes live in our neighborhoods. So once again, we have to be very intentional with our development efforts.
Let's take one more call here. Orlando is calling from Roslindale. You're on the air, Orlando.
Hi. I'm an example of one unit, six family unit building that has been bought by a real estate corporation. All of us are being told that we have to be evicted. We have to leave this building. And we, most of them, the families are hardworking families. I'm a middle income, pretty much. I work with the state. But because of a tragedy, I'm living with my teenage son now. I'm a single parent. And I really can't afford to move out. I mean, it means financial hardship. It means uprooting us from our community and the people that we know. And it's a lot of emotional distress for us as well, because we don't know where we're going to end up next. I mean, with the help of City Life and the Greater Boston Legal Services, we're struggling to negotiate with these real estate developers to see if we can get a more affordable situation. But it's really tough.
Orlando, thank you so much for sharing your story. Thank you so much for your call. With Orlando's current situation in mind, I have one last question for all of you, Chris, Justin, and Sheila. And this actually comes out of both Boston, the Boston 2030 housing plan, and a feeling that we came away with after spending a lot of time talking with people from San Francisco. Because, Sheila, in the Boston 2030 plan, there's this very simple part that caught my eye. It says, today, there are only four neighborhoods with no significant signs of gentrification. Ensuring that longtime residents are able to remain in their homes is critical for the stability of our neighborhoods. So that was echoing in my mind. And then I was thinking, in San Francisco, we literally had people tell us the problem there is so bad, they are afraid that the San Francisco they know, that they love, that they grew up with, that city may no longer exist in the near future. Should we be similarly concerned for Boston?
I think we have to be worried about preserving the Boston that we want to live in and that we love. Absolutely. But we do have more affordable housing than San Francisco does. We're putting, you know, enormous amounts of resources into creating even more. We haven't seen dramatic shifts in our income populations, although we know people are are being evicted from some parts of Boston. We're not seeing, you know, shifts from very significant shifts from our middle class and our low income. So we're maintaining a diverse city, and I think that is because we had such a stable and a large amount of affordable housing. Mm. But we should always be watching this very, very carefully, and making sure that all of our policies are aligned to keep Boston inclusive.
Chris Herbert?
I would echo what Sheila said. I mean, I think that Boston has the benefit of a long history of participating in affordable housing programs at the federal level, one of the early participants in public housing, which certainly has some of its issues. But Boston has also taken advantage of programs from the federal government to rehabilitate a lot of that housing. And so a large stock of assisted housing the city has allows for a continued presence of people of a broader set of incomes. And I think inclusionary zoning is another way to make sure that there's a cross-section of incomes that are maintained. So it's a big problem. It's not one we're going to have a simple solution to, but I think if we have a long-term vision and do have a vision for a city that has a place for people of different incomes and ensure that there's housing rented and owner-occupied for that broad range of incomes, in the long run, we'll be able to maintain that inclusive city.
Justin Steele, the last thought goes to you.
I think it's important to recognize the public implications of rising rents and evictions on public health, the quality of our neighborhoods. And I think we do need stronger tenant protections. I think we need more affordable housing. I applaud the mayor's inclusionary development program, but I think it needs to be stronger. We need much more affordable units and middle-income units, both rental and home ownership. And I think we have to support the community organizations that are representing tenants and trying to experiment with things like community land trust.
Well, I'm going to quote Boston 2030's housing vision as a final thought, that really the goal is a city of growth and prosperity for all. Justin Steele is Assistant Professor of Law and Urban Planning at MIT. Pleasure to have you on the program today. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
And Chris Herbert, Managing Director at Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies. Pleasure as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Sheila Dillon, Chief of Housing and Director of the Department of Neighborhood Development for the City of Boston. Thank you so much for joining us today, Sheila.
Thank you. Great call.
And listeners, you can go back to our website, radioboston.org, to hear every single part of our four-part series, Evictions in East Boston, the Push for a Just Cause Evictions Ordinance. Again, that's at radioboston.org. And I should say, our special series was produced by Allison Bruzek and Jamie Bologna. There's more of the show in just a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.